All right, time to get started this morning. So we're going to be finishing up the story of Ruth this morning, and this is the last of the new material that we have this quarter. So for the foundations class, we're a little ahead and have really plenty of time to cover this material. Next quarter, I think you'll have 22 or 23. Is it 22? 22? Okay. So there are a couple of extras in this class that you don't have. But you've seen, those of you who are teaching, you've seen that this material can easily be covered in 22 classes along with some review. There are some, depending on the age group, there are some stories that you can give a lot less attention to. There are also, there's plenty of opportunity to review, and I typically review at least a little bit during every session. So why don't I live up to that for just a moment? So a quick review now for what we've done, and one of the things that has really helped me as I've been studying the Bible over the years, one of the things that's really kind of helped me to solidify my Bible knowledge and to be able to call to memory things is the ability to put limits of Scripture on things. So what I mean by that is, if you think of the story of Joshua, Judges, that those are really the two stories we've covered, the invasion and conquest and the Judges. If you know who all the Judges are, and if you know the stories of Joshua and the invasion and conquest of the land, and in addition to that, if you can put scriptural limits on those periods, then when someone brings up a story, you'll be able to narrow it down within a few pages of your Bible where that story is. And then when you can narrow it down to within a few pages, you can just kind of scan until you see words that you know relate to the story, and then right there you are. And that has been, to me, one of the most valuable tools that I've had. So if you think of the invasion and conquest, right, there were really, that's the easiest part of it, right? It's just, what, where's that? Invasion and conquest. Book of Joshua, right? So if you hear a story that's related to the invasion and conquest, right away you know to go to the book of Joshua. You know, and the first four chapters are really that transition phase when Joshua's taking over and the crossing of the Jordan and so forth. So then you get the central campaign, the southern campaign, the northern campaign, right? And that's all, that really all happens in the first 11 chapters. So if it's a story of the conquest of the land, you know that in the first half of the book of Joshua, there you are. And you can find, if you can get it within 10, 11 chapters, you can flip your pages and find the story you're looking for very, very quickly. And then beyond that, you get into the division of the land, the tribal boundaries, the cities of refuge, the cities for the Levite. Those kinds of things are in the rest of the book of Joshua, and then Joshua's farewell at the end. So if you can get that grasp of Joshua in your mind and get that across to your students next quarter, the younger they are and they can get that kind of a grasp on where things are in the Bible, that is a tool that will serve them well the rest of their lives as they're studying the Bible. Then you have the period of the Judges. Now, that one's not as straightforward. Where do we find the period, the stories of the Judges? Okay, Judges, obviously. All right, where else, though? There's some more. 1 Samuel, right? 1 Samuel 1 through 8. Which two judges, the stories are told in 1 Samuel 1 through 8? Eli and Samuel. So if it's a story of Eli and Samuel, you know it's the first eight chapters of 1 Samuel, right? 1 through 8. Now, there's a little bit of Samuel just beyond that, but he's no longer serving as judge, right? At that time, Saul is king. And there will be some Samuel stories beyond chapter 8. But if it's a story related to the judging of the land, and it's Eli or Samuel, 1 Samuel 1 through 8 is where that story is. And then the other judges, they're all in the book of Judges. And then you have those, really in the last few chapters of Judges, you've got those two appendices, if you will, to the book of Judges. The first is, do you remember those two appendices? Can you summarize those stories for me? First is the migration of the Danites, right? And what story is kind of associated with that? What are the characters? Do you remember? Micah and his idol. Does that ring a bell? Ding, ding. Okay, yeah, when I say it, yeah, oh yeah, I know what you're talking about now. Yeah, so the story of Micah and his idol and the migration of the Danites. Then the second story is, anyone remember that one? The Levite and his concubine, right? And then the almost extinction of the tribe of Benjamin. Okay, so those two stories there. And then we're to today's story, which the chapter 1, verse 1 tells us happened during this time, the time of the judges. And Freddie did a good job of covering the timing of that story last time. So it's during the period of the judges. And we have the story of Ruth. That one's easy enough too. You find that in the book of Ruth, right? I wasn't going to give you that one completely. Alright, so let's go ahead and get into the story of Ruth. There are two places that are listed in the story of Ruth. You'll remember there was famine in the land. Now, Elimelech was from Bethlehem in Judah. So here's Bethlehem. But he moved his family to Moab to escape the famine. And those are really the only two geographic places that are given any attention at all in this story. But keep in mind, that's where things are. I take it when Boaz later on goes to the gates of the city, I take it the city's Bethlehem, because it seems that everything's set there at Bethlehem, Bethlehem, Judah, in this story. Alright, just a quick review. This is what Freddie covered last time, the first couple of slides, and then we'll get into the new part of the story that we haven't covered yet. Elimelech, he moved his family to Moab because of the famine. While he was there, Elimelech died there in Moab. And he had two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. So Mahlon married Ruth, and Chilion married a lady named Orpah from the land of Moab. So both of these women were Moabitess women. And later on, Mahlon and Chilion also died there in Moab. And Naomi was Elimelech's wife, kind of the matriarch of this family, if you will. And she told Orpah and Ruth to go back to their family, that she really had nothing to offer them. Both of them initially said, no, we'll go with you. But Orpah eventually turned back and went to live with her Moabite family. But Ruth clung to Naomi and returned back to the land of Judah to live in Bethlehem with Naomi. So when they got there to Bethlehem, again, there's no man to provide for them. They would have been, at this time, a poor family. And what the poor families did, those who had no way to provide for themselves, is the law set up provisions for them to go into the fields and glean. So what gleaning would mean would be picking up after the harvest. So those who were harvesting were to leave some grain behind, leave some fruit behind. They were not to go to all the corners of the fields. And if they dropped something, they weren't supposed to pick it up. They were just to leave it there. And God's purpose for that was so that the poor would have something to eat. And gleaning would have been hard work, very hard work. And you wouldn't have gotten a lot more than you could use in a day or two from gleaning. So Ruth went out to glean, and she happened to glean in the fields of Boaz. And Boaz is a kinsman of the now deceased Elimelech. And Boaz noticed this woman gleaning in his fields, asked who it was, found out that it was Ruth, and kind of the story of Ruth had spread a little bit through the land, how that she had clung to Naomi. And Naomi now calls herself Mara. You remember how she mentioned that when she got back into the land. Naomi means pleasant, Mara means bitter, and she said Jehovah had dealt bitterly with her. So one of the two things that Boaz did to show kindness to Ruth is he told his men who were working in the fields not to touch her, not to lay hands on her at all. So he offered her some protection. He also told Ruth, don't glean in any other field. Okay? Glean only in my field. And he also told her that she could go up right next to the reapers, as close as she wanted. And he also told the reapers, now what I want you to do is drop stuff on purpose for her so that she can glean. So he made her gleaning much, much easier than it would have been. And she continued there to glean through the harvest. And after the first day of gleaning, according to Bob's book, An Ephah, is what she had gotten that day, which was, and that was after it had been threshed. So she had, you know, 25, is it 25 to 30? 20 to 25 pounds of barley flour is what she had. Now, that'll last you a little while, you know, just a small household. We buy it by the 5-pound sack, right? So that'll last you a while. And Naomi noticed that, you'll remember, and she said, "Whoa, where have you been gleaning?" Because she knew that you didn't get 25 pounds of flour gleaning in a day. She knew that. And she found out that it was Boaz. And Ruth, because of the kindness that had been shown to her and because of the instructions of Naomi, Ruth continued to glean in the fields of Boaz. So that brings us up to where we are. Okay? Now we're ready for new stuff. So, Naomi, chapter 3, verse 1, says, "You need someone to provide for you." She says this to Ruth. "You need someone to provide for you, someone to take care of you, so it'll be well with you." Now this Boaz, whose fields you've been gleaning in, remember Ruth stayed there through the harvest. So some time has passed. We're now near the end of harvest in the story of Ruth. And so Naomi has a plan. Boaz, he's a near kinsman. Now I take it from that Naomi knew that there was a kinsman even nearer than Boaz. And that's going to come up a little bit later in the story. The text doesn't explicitly say that, but he is our kinsman, she knew. And at the end of the harvest, they were winnowing. Now, when you're teaching children, they're probably not going to know what the word winnowing means, right? And all the translations I looked at said that Boaz was winnowing the barley. So if you use that word, you're going to have to explain it to children. You know what that means? Okay, so maybe you have to explain it to adults too. So winnowing is the process of using air to separate the wheat, the usable part of the grain, from the chaff, the stuff that's not really usable and edible. So they would blow air over it to blow the chaff away, and you would have left the grain that would be usable. So that's what they were doing. They'd already threshed it out and beat the grain off the stalks, and now they were separating the chaff using air to do that. So he was winnowing in the threshing floor. And so Naomi tells her about this grand plan she has. So what you're to do, Ruth, is you are to put on your best garment. So she was to get really dressed up, dressed as well as she could. Take a bath. I mean, she had been gleaning all day. So take a bath, anoint yourself. Now again, if you're teaching children, anoint yourself. That's not something they're going to use. But what that meant was put on perfume. Children will understand, especially ladies that are getting on up into elementary, will understand the concept of perfume and probably will like to do that and will know the concept of dress up. So she tells her to fix herself up very nicely and go in to see Boaz, but wait. Wait until Boaz has eaten and is contented and then goes to bed. And then when he goes to bed, you go in to his room after he's gone to bed, and you uncover his feet and lay down there at his feet, and he'll tell you what to do. So that was Naomi's plan. Now this was a very unusual plan. And a couple things. I mentioned earlier that Naomi perhaps knew that, and I take it she did know, that there was a kinsman nearer than Boaz. Okay? So the way that this works, and we'll review this at the end of the story, but the nearest kinsman was the one who should have married Ruth, who had the first right to marry Ruth and to claim the land that belonged to Elimelech. Okay, that was the nearest kinsman's right to do that. And so if this request to marry Boaz had been done in a very public way, then Boaz perhaps would have declined that, knowing that there was another kinsman nearer. So that's why there was this kind of a privacy, a secrecy involved, is to make sure that Boaz knew Ruth's desire and intention to marry him and give Boaz the opportunity to handle the situation. And it works. The plan works great. And that's kind of the plan Naomi has. So Ruth does just as Naomi tells her. And so she's all dressed up, looking her best, smelling her best. And she goes to Boaz. She waits. She's there at the threshing floor, and she waits till he goes to bed. She goes in and she uncovers his feet, and then lays down there at his feet. And at about midnight is when Boaz realizes he's startled. Right? And you're like, what is that? Who's here? And who is that? And she says, "I'm Ruth. She startled him and awakened him, it's just really interesting. Let me see. Verse 8 and 9 is the kind of the dialogue between Boaz and Ruth. Who are you? Verse 9, and she says, "I'm Ruth, your maidservant." And she says, "Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a near kinsman." Does anybody else have a different translation there on verse 9? Okay, all right. That's more what I was looking for. Okay, that's more of what I was looking for. Mine's a little different because "take thy maidservant under your wing." You know, we use that figuratively a lot now to mean, you know, take me in. But really, she literally said, what was that again? "Spread your skirt over thine handmaid." So there was a small portion of the cover called the skirt. And that was to be shared between a husband and a wife, according to the law. And only by a husband and a wife. So in essence, what Ruth was doing, "spread your skirt over me," is she was requesting that Boaz marry her. So she was basically proposing to Boaz is what she was doing. Whereas, you know, our translation, "take me under thy wing," doesn't get the essence of what's going on. But the skirt would have been just a portion of the cover that Boaz had used to cover himself in the evening. That was to be shared between a husband and a wife. And it's actually used a couple times in the law as almost a euphemism's not the right word, but maybe synecdoche of marriage is what it's used for. So that's that skirt, you know, of the cover. So in essence, Ruth asked Boaz to marry her, and Boaz says, verse 10, "Blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter." Now remember, I almost just have to read this because I would forget a detail that's important. So I'll read verses 10 through, say, 13. "Blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning." What do you think he's referring to there? What did she do at the beginning? What did she do? It's not a trick question. She stayed with Naomi, right? So that's what I'm thinking that he's talking about. You showed more kindness at the end than at the beginning. And her clinging to Naomi and coming back with her. That's what I take it he's referring to. You showed more kindness at the end than at the beginning. So what do you mean by that? In that you did not go after young men. Do you see that? So she didn't come back and then try to go and find some young man for herself. She was truly interested in the best interests of Elimelech's family. That's what I take it that Boaz is saying to Ruth. And isn't that consistent with everything the Bible's revealed to us about Ruth's character thus far? That she's very selfless and interested in following the customs and laws of Jehovah. Isn't that something? At least that's what I'm impressed upon with Ruth. So I take it that's what Boaz is saying to her. And he says, "And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you request, for all the people in my town know that you're a virtuous woman." Verse 11 just really caught my eye. Because the story of Ruth certainly had gone through the city of, you know, how that she had, we find that back in the first couple of chapters. And her reputation had spread. Now, a reputation doesn't just happen. You don't just get a good reputation by doing one or two good deeds. Now, people may hear the good deeds, but Ruth was consistent. And throughout her time in Bethlehem, she had been consistently virtuous and godly, and everybody knew that. And the Bible has so many good things to say about it's almost superlative. It is superlative what the Bible has to say about a virtuous woman and the compliments that are placed upon a virtuous woman. In Proverbs in particular, verse 31, chapter 31, the description of the virtuous woman comes to my mind there, of the virtuous wife. If you find a good wife, you found a good thing, the text says. So Boaz knew that he was dealing with not just an ordinary woman, but a true salt of the earth type woman here. So he tells her to go ahead and stay the night, and in the morning it shall be. He tells her about the kinsman who's nearer, and he says, "I'll go and I'll check with him, and if he wants to perform the duty of the next of kin, that's his right, and we'll allow him to do that. But if he doesn't want to, then I will do that. I'll perform the duty of the next of kin. I'll take you as my wife," in essence, is what he says. So remember, she in essence has asked Boaz to marry her. And Boaz says, "It wouldn't quite be appropriate for me to do that. So let's check with the next of kin and see about that." And the other thing impressive about Boaz is during this, because she had gone into his room after he had gone to bed. And so what Boaz does, and really, the text gives no indication. In fact, it indicates quite the opposite, that nothing untoward had happened here this evening. That they had simply had that discussion, and she remained there in his room and slept the night. And he tells her, and gets up early in the morning and tells before daylight, and the text says before one could recognize another, and tells her to leave. And the reason he did that is he didn't want people to see her leaving from his room and get the wrong idea. She had come there for a purpose, and that was basically to propose to him, to make sure that Elimelech's family and herself would be taken care of. And so he wants her to leave before daylight so that no one would be able to tell. And the other thing is, that would have been very shameful as Boaz is going to ask this next of kin if he would like to marry her. That would have been a very shameful thing. So Ruth had a good reputation, and Boaz is very concerned about preserving that good reputation. So he sends her out early in the morning before daylight. But before she goes, he says, "Bring me your shawl or your veil or something, some kind of something she was holding." And he fills it up. Now my text says 6 ephahs of flour, but that just couldn't have been, because an ephah was, and the ephah is in italics, right? So it couldn't have been an ephah. In other words, in italics it means that wasn't in the original text. The translators just didn't use the right word there, I don't think. Because you think about it, what was an ephah we decided? 20 to 25 pounds? So 120 pounds. Is that right? 6 times? Yeah. I don't think. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. It would have been. Yeah. That would have been a lot for her to carry in a shawl anyway. But 6 measures of flour. But the point is, a very generous gift is what was given to her. A very generous gift. He sends her away with a generous gift to take back to Naomi. And she tells Naomi what has happened. And he presents the gift. She presents the gift to Naomi. And Naomi says, "Be still. You'll figure out. We'll see. Let's wait till tomorrow. He won't waste any time about this. He'll take care of this fairly quickly. So you just wait till tomorrow and we'll see what happens." So what Boaz does, just as Naomi predicted, Boaz goes to the gate of the city. And there at the gate of the city, he's sitting there. Now it turns out, it seems that at the gate of the city is where a lot of the business was done, the public business was done. And as he's there at the gate of the city, the next of kin comes by. Okay? The one who was closer kin to Elimelech than Boaz himself. And he comes by and he asks him, "Stop, wait a minute, meet with me here." And then he gathers up 10 elders of the city and calls them to sit and meet there. And so they do this. Everything's on the up and up. Hey, everything is there. It's formal. There would be no backing out of this. This is official. Everything's official. And he asks him, he says, "Elimelech, you're the nearest of kin left to Elimelech. He lost his sons and he has nothing but, the daughters-in-law. He's lost his sons. And he himself is dead. You're the next of kin. There's this piece of land that Naomi has sold. And if you want to redeem it, you can redeem it. It'll become yours. Now, when he hears that, sounds like a good deal. What? I just get to add more land to my land? Yeah, I'll take it. I'll take it. I'd like to do that. So he says, yeah, I want to redeem it. Then Boaz says, now, also, when you take this land, you also, it's a package deal. There's a wife of one of Elimelech's sons who goes with that land. Now, here's where he backs out. And he backs out because, you know, it's not because he didn't want to get married or anything like that. I don't take that at all. I mean, in those days, they had more than one wife. And that's not it at all. But what would happen is, now think this through, that piece of land, whose would that land have been? That piece of land that he gets from Naomi, whose would that have been? It would have been Elimelech's, right? It would have been the son. Yes, the child that they would have, that he would have with Ruth. It would have been that child's land, and it would have gone back through Elimelech, not through his own father. So that land would have stayed with Elimelech's family. So he would have gotten the land only temporarily, only until that firstborn son, and then that would have continued off separately from his land and his father's land. So when he learns that, he says, never mind. And his reasoning is, that would take away from my own inheritance. In other words, he was saying, whether it was true or not, I don't know, it could have been. But he was saying, I have enough land to take care of myself, and I don't have the resources to take care of someone else's land for them in addition to my land. That's kind of what I take him to be saying. That I would have be spending my resources on something that's not even mine. I can't do that.
He was not married. At this particular time, he married Ruth. This child would have also got his inheritance and Elimelech.
That's a good point. That's a good point. I hadn't thought of. Yeah. So everyone hear what Freddie said? So. Yeah. So yeah, that's something I hadn't thought of as well. I just kind of assumed that he was married. Also, but yeah, that is true. If he weren't married, then yeah, that son would have gotten Elimelech's and his own land. So when Boaz explains that there's a wife of the dead heir whom he would also have to marry in order to get this land, he says, "Nope, I don't want it." And he changes his mind. So after learning that, he declines. And then Boaz was the next nearest kin. Beyond this kinsman here that this dialogue's been happening with. Remember, the elders are witnesses, the dialogue's between Boaz and this next of kin. So Boaz now has the right to redeem the land. And in that day, the custom was when you either sold a piece of land or gave up the rights to redeem a piece of land, you would take off your shoe and give it to the person that you either gave that right to or sold the land to. And that was the custom in that day. So the man took off his shoe and gave it to Boaz and did this here in the presence of all the people who were there. And so it became official then that even though this nearest of kin had the right to redeem that land, he had chosen not to and had given that right to Boaz, the next of kin, and gave him his shoe. And so this is now formal. And there are witnesses there of the whole thing. It's official. And Boaz even says that in verse 9. You are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Kilian's and Mahlon's from the hand of Naomi. So that land now became Boaz's until Boaz and Ruth would have a son. Then it would belong to their son, which we'll learn about a little bit later on. Who he was. He turned out to be a fairly important person himself.
Do they get their shoe back?
I don't know if they get their shoe back or not. It's a good question.
they probably do. It's just a
formality. Yeah. Yeah. And when this is... when this is learned about throughout the town, There's the people who were there at the gate, verse 11, said, "We are witnesses. The Lord make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah." So very, you know, they're happy for Ruth. Apparently her reputation was here among these as well. And they're pronouncing a blessing. May you prosper in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. May your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah because of the offspring which the Lord will give you from this young woman. So it's kind of almost prophetic there, isn't it? Almost, because it did follow the lineage of Perez from Judah, and it was definitely important to the overall story. So Boaz married Ruth, and Ruth gives birth to a son as a result of this marriage, and his name is Obed. So Obed is the son of Ruth through Boaz, and Naomi and the women with her rejoiced at this. And Naomi took him. The Bible doesn't put a lot of emphasis on this, but you can imagine Naomi's joy in this. And now her husband, whom she loved, and you remember how she changed her name from Naomi to Mara because of the loss. And so this is a woman who has been through a lot. She's been through famine. She's been through the death of her husband. She's been through the death of her two sons. She's lost a daughter-in-law who chose to stay behind. And she's kept one daughter-in-law for sure. And Ruth has really been kind of her rock through all of this. And now, you know there would have been a very strong love between Naomi and Ruth, and a very much a closeness there. And you get that from the dialogue, even in the story. And now Ruth has a son. And if grandmothers here don't have to have it, use any imagination at all to imagine the joy that Naomi had with the birth of the son. And it says she took him as nurse. Naomi did. The women who were with her said, "Blessed be the Lord," verse 14, "who has not left you this day without a near kinsman. And may His name be famous in Israel." Again, that's prophetic, isn't it? Obed begat Jesse. Jesse begat David. Okay? So it's definitely he becomes famous there. And Obed was the son's name. And the lineage, and then verses 18 through 22 give us the lineage from Perez, who ironically was mentioned just a little bit earlier in the story, from Perez up through David. So that was the story of Ruth. Alright, so real quick, I wanted to point out, any questions though? That was the story. Thoughts on that, on the story? Before I want to get into this, because if you're teaching this to children, they may not understand why certain things are happening, and you can give them this background. You may even do this before the story, if you'd like, or at least before that part of the story where this comes into play. But I did want to cover this of the laws of levirate marriages. And that just means, this is a word we don't use every day, right? And you see Levi and you might think Levitical or something like that. That's not it at all. Okay? It just, that L-E-V-I-R happens to be Latin for brother. So levirate means the sometimes compulsory marriage of a widow to her deceased husband's brother. And in the days when multiple wives were acceptable for a man, that this would have made a lot more sense, because he could just take on another wife in addition to the one he had. And so there were laws about that. These marriages were sanctioned and regulated in the law. So let's look back at Deuteronomy chapter 25, and we'll see the regulations on that. And actually, we're going to see something that's a little similar to what we saw in the story. In Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 5 through 10. So, if brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother shall go into her, take her as wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn son which she bears will succeed to the name of his dead brother. Okay, not his own name, but his brother's name is who that this firstborn would take on. And it shall be that the firstborn will succeed the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. But if the man does not want to take his brother's wife, so here again, the law doesn't require that brother to marry this widow. It's not an absolute requirement. But keep reading and you'll find out that it almost is a requirement. Okay? But if the man does not want to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go to the gate to the elders and say, "My husband's brother refuses to raise up a name to his brother in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother." Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him. And if he stands firm and says, "I do not want to take her." So again, the brother has the option. The elders have the, you know, it's almost their duty to try to talk him into this. They're to talk to him. And then if he refuses, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders, verse 9, remove his sandal from his foot, spit in his face, and answer and say, "So shall it be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel, the house of him who had his sandal removed." Okay, so it was not an answer. He had the option to decline it, definitely. But that option was a very shameful thing for him to do. Very shameful to not do that. Now, I take this to be the case of a brother. And now, back in the story of Ruth, the next kinsman was not a brother. So I don't know if this same type of shame extended that far beyond the immediate family or not. But it was still, it seemed unusual that he wouldn't do it. And in fact, I don't know. I don't know all the answers to that. But the similarity of taking off the shoe kind of struck me, though they are completely different cases. I take this in the story of Ruth because there was no spitting in the face, and the text doesn't go out of the way at all to shame this man for what he had done. That it was a different case here when a brother wouldn't do it versus when the nearer of kin wouldn't do it. But that similarity of the sandal, taking the sandal off, I take that to be merely coincidence. Because the sandal here was something in the law, and it was, and it was to have that shame kind of continue on. You know, because he would be known as the man who had his shoe took off, right? In this case, it seemed like it was more of a custom in the story of Ruth, where that if you sold land, you would take off your shoe and give that to one you sold, kind of like a, almost like a deed to the property kind of a thing, rather than an emblem of shame. In this case, in Deuteronomy, it was an emblem of shame. Nothing about that. We don't know anything about him other than that he was nearer kin than Boaz was. That's really all I know about him. Does anyone else have any? We just don't know. I mean, that he was from the area. He was, you know, he lived nearby. Lived in Bethlehem. That we know. And the reason I say that is back in verse 5. If brothers dwell together, so I take it to mean if they live in the same general vicinity. So the kinsman here would have lived in the same general vicinity. And when you add to that, that he was passing through the gate, and Boaz expected to see him passing through the gate of the city. I take that, he lived in that area. And so this property would have been close to his home. Yeah.
I guess we don't know Boaz.
No, we don't know that, do we? Don't know that at all, whether Boaz. I don't know of any other. And the text implies even that Boaz and Ruth were alone when she came to visit him. I think that's strongly implied by the text, though not. I don't know that it's explicitly stated there. So yeah, I think that's. If I had to say one way or another, I would say Boaz was not married at this time, just based on that evidence. Yes. That could be. Yeah. 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 No, I think that makes very good sense. That's a very good deduction from the story. Yeah, I think so. I think so. That's reasonable. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We kind of see that anyway, but in the last chapter, though, she's specifically referred to as a young.
Yeah, and you're right. We do see that in the work she's able to do. An old woman couldn't have done the type of work she did. Yeah, you're right. Very good. And the text does explicitly say that as well.
Mm-hmm. I thought about it tonight, it's called his daughter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So there was an age difference between Boaz and Ruth. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. That is right. All right. Not a lot of time, but you know, the incident of Zelophehad's daughters, you may remember that from Numbers chapter 27, where there were no sons, and so the land was to stay there in that same clan. And that gives us the most insight into the laws of inheritance. These two laws are not directly tied together. There's no text that ties these together, but you can see very clearly how that custom and practice would definitely tie these together. If there was a man, you know, who had land and died, but also had a wife, that the land and the wife would be a package deal. That's pretty obvious that would be part of the custom. And so by custom and practice, you know, the law of Levirate marriages and the laws of inheritance were very much tied together. And we see in the story that at least by custom, they were definitely tied together. Almost with the full force of law. You can see they were tied together. That's it. Thank you very much for your attention. I really enjoyed this quarter of teaching.